Ephesians chapter 6, as we continue to make our way through this great book, the book of Ephesians. And today we come to the topic of work. Work. Does just the sound of that word work bring connotations of sweat, dirt, drudgery? Maybe when you think of work, you think of having to get up too early. You think of that awful sound of the alarm clock. Maybe you think of an angry boss or having to wear a tie when you think of work. I hate ties. Or maybe you think of work and your mouth waters somewhat because you're one of those success-driven, climb the corporate ladder kind of guys or girls. Maybe you think of an alarm clock and you think, yeah, get in early. Maybe the tape deck in the car is a means of catching up on some new sales strategies. The commute to and from work is a mobile office, working the phone and the pen right from and back to the front porch at home. Well, all of us lean towards one of these extremes or the other. Either we think too little of work or we think too much of it. Either being lazy or making an idol of our work. We were created for work, but not like either of those. We were created not to dodge work. The goal of life is not to put off today what you can do tomorrow. And the goal of life is not with self-exaltation and self-pride and self-promotion to work to our own glory in a way that exalts our strength, our wisdom, our grit. So two extremes. Ironically, slavery is the one thing I can think of that embraces both extremes at the same time. In many eras of humanity, work was characterized as a low-class piece of culture, and slavery was the way you got work done without having to do it yourself. And that's an unbiblical laziness that doesn't realize that we imitate God who works as we work. Oftentimes with slavery, greed and hunger, a love for money, and a lack of love for people drove masters to drive their slaves all the harder. So ironically, slavery becomes the one way in which you can do both of these unbiblical, sinful extremes when it comes to work. You can be lazy, never pick up a rake. And you can be hungry for power and wealth at the same time. When Paul says in Ephesians 6:5, slaves, be obedient to those who are your masters, he has to be understood in his first century context. At its best in first century time, slaves and masters meant little more than workers and bosses. Paul was a first century guy, a man of his times. And so this would have been something like contractual labor. Many slaves even received an inheritance from their masters. Some were given more of an inheritance than their bloodlined children received. Sometimes masters wept at the death of one of their slaves. So as we look at Ephesians 6 this morning, don't get caught up in the language of slaves and masters. Paul was a first century guy and needs to be understood in that context. And of course, many biblical principles run straight against the disgustingly sad and blatantly sinful slave trades we know all too well in this country. America and England were the first people, the first civilization to limit slavery to a race or a color. And that has little to do with what Paul is saying for us today in Ephesians 6. But Paul has much to say to us today for workers and bosses, for those who punch the clock and for those who stay at home, for those that go in and wear a tie and for those who take care of kids. Ephesians 6, let's read verses 5 to 9 together. Slaves, be obedient to those who are your masters according to the flesh, with fear and trembling in the sincerity of your heart as to Christ. Not by way of eye service as men pleasers, but as slaves of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, with good will render service as to the Lord and not to men, knowing that whatever good thing each one does, this he'll receive back from the Lord, whether slave or free. And masters, do the same things to them. And give up threatening, knowing that both their master and yours is in heaven, and there's no partiality with him. Verses 5 to 8 of this passage talks about workers. Verse 9 talks about bosses, we could say. The calling of workers here is first that they be obedient. Obedience is the first calling of workers. You see it in verse 5. Obey. Be obedient to those who are your masters. Follow what they say. What they instruct us in is not optional. They're over us. Remember, we've been learning in Ephesians 5, in verse 21, that everyone is subject to someone else in the fear of Christ. Wives are subject to their husbands. Children are subject to their parents. And then the third category Paul gives us is that workers are subject to their masters. It's the way it works, and Paul tells us, obey, do what they say. But secondly, it has to do with attitude as well. Verse 5 talks about fear and trembling. Do it with a healthy respect. Do it not with just eye service, he'll go on to say. Do it not just because you have to. Do it not just by the letter of the law, but do it with the right attitude. Respect those who are over you because they're there by the Lord's sovereign purpose in your life. It's in his providence that you have the job that you have and that you have the boss that you have. We need to be careful that we don't complain about what the Lord has put in our lives. Do you remember in the Exodus, the children of Israel were traveling around in the desert, complaining about the manna, complaining about the fact that they're in the desert and they've been there so long. And Moses says something interesting to them. Your complaining is unto the Lord. You see, they thought on a human plane they were going to Moses to complain. They thought, Moses, we're mad at you because you brought us out here. We're mad at you because we have to eat manna all day. And Moses says, you're murmuring, you're complaining, is a complaining that's unto the Lord. We can complain about our bosses all we want. We can complain about how hard our jobs are all we want. But ultimately, if God is in control, he has the boss for you that he has. You have the job that you have for a reason, and he's in it. And our complaining is ultimately unto the Lord. So thirdly, we need to have honesty. The calling of workers is thirdly, honesty. Verse 5 says, with sincerity of heart. You have to have a good heart in this. Mean well in this. Sincere in your dealings. Honest with him. Honest with her. And lastly, the calling of workers is worship. Verse 5 just says, as to Christ. You do this ultimately as to Christ. Colossians 3:23 tells us, whatever you do, do it heartily as unto the Lord and not unto men. Ultimately, what we do in our work, in our job, in our homes, is unto the Lord. It's secondly that we do it for a person. It's secondly that we do it for a paycheck. We do it ultimately as worship unto the Lord. And then Paul will go on to describe what he means by this as to Christ thing. In verse 6, he says, not merely men-pleasing. Not just pleasing that man or that woman who's over you. Not as men-pleasers, he says in verse 6. So it's not just a horizontal plane relationship that we're dealing with from 9 to 5. There's something vertical going on as well. We do it ultimately as worship, and we do it ultimately not as just pleasing men or fearing men for that matter, but ultimately pleasing God and fearing God. He also says in verse 6, not just doing what men see, not just with eye service. Isn't it easy, especially in a big corporation, to get lost in the shuffle, read your newspaper a lot more than you really work for the company? Get on the internet a lot more than you do work for the company. It's easy to do, isn't it? It's easy to justify. It's easy to get away with. It's easy when the boss isn't working to slow down a little bit and pick up the pace when he reappears, isn't it? But that is not Christian labor. That's not biblical work. Biblical work here is doing your utmost for the Lord as unto the Lord and not just when the boss sees. If it's just a human plane, then sure, when the boss is there, work your hardest and you'll get the promotion. And when he's not, loaf. But if there's a vertical plane and God sees, you notice that? See that? Let's see, in verse 7. I'm sorry, it's not in verse 7, it's in verse 8. Knowing that both their master and yours is in what? Heaven, it says. In other words, he sees. He sees all, so we must do it, not just pleasing men, not just what men see. We must do it working ultimately for Christ. Look at what verse 7 says. For God will render service as to the Lord and not to men. God doesn't give bonuses for your hard work for men alone. He gives his bonuses based on our work for him. Working ultimately for Christ. Verse 6 also describes it like this. But as slaves of Christ. Ultimately, your employer is Christ. Ultimately, you work for him. Ultimately, you're an employee of Jesus Christ, a slave of his. Paul called himself a bond slave. Verse 6 also says, doing God's will. This is part of worship. This is part of our work as to Christ. Doing God's will, ultimately obeying our masters, honoring them as we should, is ultimately God's will. It's ultimately his command. It's ultimately obeying and honoring him. And verse 8 just tells us that we should be mindful of a bigger bonus. Knowing that whatever good thing each one does, this he'll receive back from the Lord, whether slave or free. Whatever good we do ultimately is recompensed and bonused, we could say, from the Lord, not from men. We need to be mindful of a bigger bonus than our Christmas bonuses. We need to be mindful of the bonus that comes from the Lord. And this is part of worship, as to Christ work. And this is the calling of every Christian worker in here. This is the calling that is before you and on your life. You're not given the luxury of just having some sort of separate, sacred, and secular division in your life. It's easy to think that Sunday's about the Lord, but Monday through Friday is about me, about the bonus, about the job, about the paycheck, about the work. No, whatever we do it as unto the Lord. Whether we eat or drink, we do it to what? God's glory. Whether we eat, drink, or work 9 to 5, we do it to God's glory. Well, this is the calling of workers. How about the calling of bosses in verse 9? Well, he says, firstly, that you need to be mindful of the workers. He says, do the same things to them, the beginning of verse 9. In other words, be mindful of them. Do as unto them as they would have that, as you would have them do unto you. Be mindful. Put yourself in their shoes, bosses. Put yourself in their shoes and realize that you were there once too. You're no better. You need to be mindful of where they are. But be mindful of God also. Secondly, be mindful of God. Do the same things means do it just like Paul's already described. Do it obediently. Do it with a right attitude. Do it honestly. And do it as to Christ. Do it as worship. So whether you're a worker or whether you're a boss, whether you're a CEO or a janitor, whatever, you do it as worship, as unto the Lord. Be mindful of God, bosses. And thirdly, he says, don't threaten. Give up threatening. Isn't that interesting, that phrase? Give up threatening. He almost assumes that all bosses do threaten. They need to give it up. Every boss needs to give up threatening. Oh, how much that's the case today where threats come and rule the roost of the job place. They are the means by which things happen and get done. Be harsh, be cruel, be abusive. Get on that edge, that borderline of what might not sue you, but still is harsh and cruel almost. It's not much different in a sense than the whipping of a slave. It's just done emotionally and mentally. Well, don't threaten. Give up threatening. Why? Because it's not mindful of the workers. You don't work well in that kind of situation. Don't put them in it either. And fourthly, recognize their equality with you. Well, that's a huge one, isn't it? Recognize their equality with you. He says there's no partiality with God. There's no partiality. You're the same as they are. You're a sinner forgiven just as they are. You have no hope before God. You have no reason in and of yourself to pat yourself on the back. And even your success, as it were, from men's standpoint, is just a gift of the Lord, isn't it? 1 Corinthians 4:7 says, "What do you have that you have not received?" And if you've received it, then where is boasting? Where is bragging? No, there is no boasting before the Lord. And so your job needs to recognize, you as bosses especially, need to recognize that everyone in the corporation has equality with you. You're no better. You just have a different role. And isn't that the same, we've said already, with husbands and wives and children and parents? They're not inferior in their worth. They just have different roles. Well, now it looks like we're done with our study this morning, doesn't it? But we're not. Get comfy. Because all this is just introduction for us to think long and hard about work in general. Do you hear all that Paul said in Ephesians 6? And you want to do better, but you still say yourself, you hear yourself saying, "Okay, I'll do better. I'll be nicer to my boss. I'll work harder when he isn't looking, but I still hate my job." Do you think that? Or maybe someone would say, "You mean I have to do more than I'm already doing? You're telling me that Christian biblical work requires even more thought, more care, more passion than I'm already given my job?" Stink. I don't like that. Well, I don't want you to go away with another burden. I want you to go away, as it were, clicking your heels about your job. I know what you're thinking. You've been working in a church far too long, if you think that. I don't think that's the case. I think what we need is a vision, a grand vision of God's plan and purposes for work in our lives. Work isn't an accident, and work isn't the curse. So why is it here, and why can Paul be so positive? And yet, why is this positive message Paul brings to us so foreign to our experience? Why does it rub us such the wrong way where we think, "I don't like work, I don't want work. If I could retire at 35, you bet I would. I'd sit in a hammock for the next 35 or 40 years. That's fine with me." Well, work isn't the curse, and we need to think through these things. We want, at the end of this, to go away from here whistling with the seven dwarfs. Hi-ho, hi-ho, it's off to work we go. I thought about titling this message, "Work Isn't Just a Four-Letter Word." And some of us think that, don't we? We need to rethink work so we can leave here not thinking it's just a four-letter word. So some thoughts on God's design and purposes for work. You can turn your sermon notes page over and jot down some of the things we'll talk about here. The first place we begin is with God. God worked in the 6 days of creation. He worked. Isn't it fascinating? The first thing we really see about God is that He works. He creates and He rests. This is what our God does. First and foremost, God is revealed as a creator. And maybe we could substitute the word worker. Because He worked and then He rests. And God calls man to work even before the fall. Even before the fall, man is categorizing the animals, subduing the earth, it says, and working the ground, Genesis 2:5 says. And man is made in the image of God. Man is supposed to create, and man is supposed to work, because he's made in the image of God. His God makes beautiful things. His God invents. His God works. His God takes glory. We say today, He takes pride in His work. I thought about, what's the good Christian substitute for taking pride in your work? Because we know the Bible really only talks about pride in a negative way. We don't want to take pride in our work. But we can work to God's glory like God does. We can work obeying Him and honoring Him and serving in His strength in a way that He gets the glory. As part of imitating God and being His image bearers. So remember, we're told early on in the book of Genesis that we're made in the image of God. And we want to know what that is. Big essays and books have been written on what the image of God is in man. And one thing that seems to always go unnoticed is that God works. First and foremost, in Genesis, God is revealed as the Creator who works and rests. At the heart of work, John Piper says, is imitating God in His work. At the heart of that is creativity. If you're God, your work is to create out of nothing. If you're not God but human, your work is to consciously take what God has made and shape it and use it to make Him look great. Isn't that great? That's work. That's our duty as image bearers of God, to take what He has made, form it, shape it, invent it, create it. Not out of nothing, only God can do that. But we bear the image of God, unlike animals, as His image bearers as we work. Work, as I said, isn't just part of the curse. It's frustration and labor that's part of the curse. But man was working the ground even before the curse. The curse is frustration amidst your labor. Literally, in Genesis, it's the toil in the soil. It's when thistles grow up and weeds are there. Work got harder after the curse, but work has always been for men and women. We need to keep that in mind. And God still works, doesn't He? He rested on the seventh day, but today He works for our redemption, we're told in Scripture. He works to sustain the earth and keep it going. He works His providence and sovereignty to provide and care for all of His creation. God still works, and He works beautifully and masterfully and completely. God never works half-heartedly. God never works with complaint or reluctantly or lazily. In everything He does, God does with all of His might. And so should we. God glories in His beauty and His skill and His wisdom and His power to create and sustain something. And then He calls us, even invites us, no, even commands us to join Him, to imitate Him in doing this wonderful thing. Isn't it an amazing thing that we have the right, the commandment, the prerogative, the responsibility of doing this thing that God does because we bear His image? So you can see how it's worship, I hope. And God calls us, like I said, just like Him who does it in beauty and skill and wisdom and power, so God calls us to do it with craftsmanship and workmanship. Look at Exodus 31 up here on the screen. Exodus 31, 2 through 5 just says this. See, I've called by My name Bezalel, the son of Uri, the son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah. I filled him with the Spirit of God and wisdom, in understanding, in knowledge, and in all kinds of craftsmanship, to make artistic designs for work in gold, in silver, and in bronze, and in the cutting of stones for settings, and the carving of wood, that he may work in all kinds of craftsmanship. Isn't it amazing that the first filling of the Spirit in the Scriptures is for creativity? It's for craftsmanship. It's for a steady hand. It's for workmanship. It's for building. The first Spirit filling in all the Bible is to build something. Doesn't that make you just want to go out and build something? It does me. Isn't it fascinating that Jesus worked on wood for 2 decades? Let that sink in, friend. Jesus worked on wood for 2 decades. Jesus worked on wood for 2 decades. Doesn't that blow your mind? Do you think he was sitting around for 2 decades saying, I hate this stinking wood. I can't wait to start teaching. I can't wait to do something really profitable with my life. Oh, if only people would think I was old enough and they would give me more responsibility, then I could really do something important with my life. Was Jesus not God, righteous, worshipful, God-centered in his carpentry? Was he not obeying the law perfectly and honoring his Father completely in his woodworking? Doesn't that blow you away? That Jesus was not on hold for 2 decades, just watching the clock until he got to age 30. I guess I'll work on some wood while I'm waiting. No! Heavens no! He did it with all of his might and all of his strength and all of his wisdom. He learned the trade from his father. He did it to God's glory. No doubt he did it well. God, Jesus, worked on wood for 2 decades. Paul was a tent maker. And because it was the tradition of the rabbis for them to know something besides how to read big books, every rabbi grew up learning a trade. Could you imagine if our seminaries today required cabinet making as part of their programs? Well, the Old Testament rabbis did. They required a trade. And Paul did his trade, and he wasn't ashamed of it. He wasn't ashamed when the ministry no longer supported him and he had to go out and make some tents. He wasn't ashamed by that. No, he was glad to do it. He mentions it at least 3 times in the New Testament that he was a tent maker. And then he taught us about work. Listen to 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 11. Paul tells us to make it our ambition to lead a quiet life and attend to your own business and work with your hands, just as we commanded you. Ephesians 4:28, Paul says this, "He who steals must no longer steal, but rather he must labor, performing with his own hands what is good, so he'll have something to share with one who has need." This lack of vision in sinful human beings who forget that they're made to imitate God in work is part of our problem with unemployment today. Yes, some people can't work, and there are many people who just plain won't work. But for those who can and will work, it is a noble, God-centered, God-glorifying thing to find them work, isn't it? Incidentally, we as a church need to find a job for our brother David Sandoval. He needs work, and if you know of anything, you need to talk to him about that and let him know. It's a concern for him and his family. What a perfect Sunday for us to mention this and say, work is a good thing. Working with your hands, working with your head, working with your eyes is a good thing. We should be more concerned about providing that work and seeing to it that we can help brothers and sisters in the Lord who need work. David Sandoval is one of those. And you can either call him or call the church if you have any suggestions or opportunities for him. Paul says twice here in these passages we've read, work with your hands. Work with your hands. You probably never have thought that working with your hands could be worship. Could be something of an act of obedience toward God. Doug Wilson, describing this, working with your hands, says this, "Hands on a keyboard writing a poem or novel, hands chopping wood, hands framing a house, hands on a drafting table designing the next space shuttle, hands under the hood of a car, hands ministering to the sick, hands picking up the living room, hands holding a scalpel and removing a tumor, hands buttoning up a small child's coat, hands cutting hair, hands cradling a hunting rifle, hands arranging a table setting and serving a platter of hot food, hands laying brick, hands positioned perfectly on a basketball while playing horse in the driveway." As I said, doesn't that make you just want to go out and build something? God gave us hands. He gave us opposable thumbs. Dogs can't pick up hammers. We were made to work. We were made to think through these things. It's not a have to, it's a get to. It's what you were made for. It's what you're called to do. So we imitate God when we chop lumber or fix food or clean house or work on chaos theory at the Sandia Labs. Whatever you do, from changing diapers to being the president of the United States, there's something, and experience tells you this too, doesn't it? There's something satisfying. Something special about that kind of glad rest at the end of a busy God-glorifying workday. Sarah Edwards, the wife of Jonathan Edwards, once said, "Oh, how good it is to work for God in the daytime and lay down at night under His smiles." And that satisfaction, that peace, that rest is ultimately worship to God, not worship to self, not self-glorifying, not self-focused. If we get this wrong and it just becomes, yes, work hard, I'm excited about work, but it never moves upward in our thoughts and in our hearts, you've made an idol of yourself and in your own strength. You've made an idol of your work, and you've come to worship not the living God, but what your hands have made. It becomes no different than the Tower of Babel. It becomes no different than the idols of the Old Testament, where people made it with their hands and looked and liked it. Not for God, but for themselves. So there's a danger here. This is a fine edge to walk on, isn't it? And we either go to one extreme or the other. We either care less and are lazy, and we should be somewhere over here. Or else, no, we work hard, but we work hard to our self-glory. We work hard to the prowess of our grit and determination and commitment and strength and wisdom, when it should be all to God's. It really comes down to an issue, as I said, of not separating the sacred from the secular. It's easy to think that what we do on Sunday is special with God, and what we do on Monday is drudgery and torture because we have to pay the bills. Not so in the Scriptures, friend. Little or big, medial or important by the world standards, all is to be worship. When was the last time your work was worship to God? William Tyndale said that this renders every task an intrinsic value and integrates every vocation with a Christian spiritual life. It makes every job consequential by making it an arena for glorifying God and obeying God and expressing one's love through service to his neighbor. John Cotton put it like this: God is in the barn and God is in the chapel. The worship between them might be different, but they are both worship. Isn't that neat? God is in the barn. Yes, he's in the chapel. Yes, he meets with us in a special way here. But do you think he's not there putting on horseshoes? Is he not there when you type at a computer? Can it not be done unto his glory? An old saying for this is that all of life is coram Deo, a Latin phrase which just means before the face of God. Everything we do needs to be coram Deo, before the face of God, with his smile, with his eyes upon us, and whether we do small or big, great or little. We need to stress that this issue is not just for the important jobs. It's for every job. And it's not just for the 9-to-5 punch-a-clock job as opposed to a stay-at-home mom who changes diapers. This affects everything. This transforms the way you do dishes, friend. This transforms the way you clean out your garage. This transforms the way you do spring cleaning. This transforms the way you paint. Paint to God's glory. Think on God when you rake. Think on God when you dig. Because you were made for this, and you imitate God in this. It's worship. And God is in the barn as he is the chapel. Well, let me give you some quick implications for working biblically. If all this is true, then that means we do this happily, not begrudgingly. We do it happily, not begrudgingly. We don't do it half-heartedly or reluctantly. We don't do it complaining. We do it happily as unto the Lord and not unto men. Secondly, we do it heartily, not lazily. We do it with all of our hearts, not just with a good attitude, but with all of our energy as well. It's good to tire yourself out in your work. The Lord's glorified in hearty work, not laziness. Thirdly, we do it contented, without anxiety. We do it contented without anxiety because He's the Lord. He's in control. We don't go about our work saying, if I don't get to this, I won't get my bonus. We won't pay our bills. Sweat, anguish, ulcer, oh no. No, we do it to the Lord and we do it trusting Him. We do it with all of our might, sure. But ultimately, we do it trusting the Lord. Remember what Jesus said? And there's a balance here, isn't there? Jesus told us, look at the birds who don't wear backpacks of food. They don't store it up. No bird has a barn. They don't store up their food. They get it day by day. He said, go to the birds. But we also compare that and contrast that with, remember, one of us, all of us are on one extreme or another. What did Proverbs say? Go to the ant, you sluggard. Which lesson you need? Go to the ant or look to the birds? You need one of those in your life. Some of us will do it stressing, with anxiety. We'll do it in our own strength and our own energies. To that person, look at the birds. But to the person who lazily kicks back and says, well, God hasn't provided me a job yet. I'm just going to sit here and watch TV until He does. Go to the ant. Look at the ant who picks up more weight than his whole body. And he's just an ant. He has no purpose in life other than just being an ant. He just moves dirt and puts it in piles. That's his whole life. He digs tunnels. Why? I don't know. Have you wondered that? Why do they dig tunnels? Why are they always working so hard? Just walk around on the concrete. That's just fine. Yeah, you might get stepped on, but who knows? You could suffocate in the dirt. So I don't know why they do it, but they work hard. They know to work hard. And really it raises the question for us about our work versus the animals' work. Think about it. Beavers work cleverly. Ants work mightily. There are all kinds of animals that aren't lazy, like your bloodhound dog. So that means that it's not enough for us to do our work and not be lazy. That's a given. You need to do your work and not be lazy. But you haven't reached the image of God yet, because there are all kinds of animals at work. It's not enough to do your work without complaint, because I've never seen a beaver or an ant complain. It's not enough to do your work well and neatly and honestly and beautifully, because spiders can make the coolest, most intricate webs. We must do it mindful of the two greatest commandments. What are the two greatest commandments? Jesus said, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, even in your work. And the second is like it, to love your neighbor as yourself. Provide something of intrinsic good in what you do. Whether it's selling cars and providing transportation for people, or rounding off infinity in the national labs, whatever it is you're doing, do it heartily as unto the Lord. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. And do it caring for your neighbor. Do it providing, consciously providing. Isn't it interesting that we never see a beaver building another dam for another beaver? They take care of themselves. Spiders don't help spiders out. You need a hand with that web? No, they're on their own. But we consciously can do it unto God's glory, unlike anything in the animal kingdom. And we consciously can do it loving our neighbor as ourselves, unlike anything in the animal kingdom. Hence, the image of God. So we do it contented without anxiety. We do it for God, not men. We do it for God's glory, not our own. We do it as worship, not secularly. Learn to despise the word secular, because God's in the barn as well as the chapel. Do it well, not sloppily or half-heartedly, because our God never works that way. If you're cleaning, clean to the cleanest, because our God does all with His own heart, with all His heart. Do it in God's strength, not your own. And do it as an act of love for others, not yourself. Do it, lastly, providing. Isn't it interesting that especially men, we're called to provide for our homes and our families. And in this special way of working, we imitate God all the more, who provides for His creation. Well, like I said, it makes me want to go out and work on something today. My dad is in town this weekend, and we were moving lights in the house yesterday, and I was thinking about work. You know, you come close to getting a little jolt from the 110, and you think, we're working. Yeah. I had this message on my mind. Work for God's glory. Climb the ladder in His strength. Screw all the way because God does it completely. I have so many things floating around in my head that my dad taught me. Job worth doing, worth doing well. If you're not going to finish it, don't do it. You know, all these things that as a teenager I thought he was weird. And now I think he must be the most biblical worker I know. And I thank him for that example. So parents, teach it to your children. Because we live in a lethargic age where they want to sit in front of PlayStation 2 all day. Teach them to work. And teach them about the nobility and the worship of work. God's glorified in it. One last thought is that this thing of work and rest pops up again in Scripture. And the most important part, when Jesus says, come unto me, all you who are weary from work and heavy laden from trying, and I will give you rest. The gospel, ironically, takes this principle and turns it 180. The gospel message is all rest and no work. It says in Romans 4, verses 4 and 5, to the one who works, his wage is not credited as grace, but what is due. In other words, if you're working for something, then what you get back is just a wage. It's not a gift. But verse 5 says, to the one who does not work, but believes, just rests in him who justifies the ungodly, his faith is credited as righteousness. You work and work unto the Lord. But don't ever think that you work your way to heaven. When it comes to heaven, you rest, and you rest completely. Here, down here, we might have 6 in 1, work 6 days, rest on the Sabbath. But in Christ and in salvation, every day is a Sabbath, isn't it? There are no work days when it comes to your heavenly hope, only rest. Rest in Him.